We're very happy to have you on Arab Talk today, and I don't think it's quite fair to say these new events in Haditha, because the story's kind of been brewing for a while, and I know that you've been actually reporting on it for some time now. What's happened is that it's made it into the corporate media, but for our listeners who may not know about Haditha, maybe you could just like tell our listeners what we're talking about when we speak about Haditha and what the story is about.
Right. Basically, what happened is last November in Haditha, a town basically in not too far north of Baghdad. It is right in the heart of the so-called Sunni Triangle, where resistance against the occupation is fiercest. And what happened was the U.S. military, the Marines, were running a patrol of four Humvees. They were hit by a roadside bomb, which immediately killed one of them, and they basically went into four houses that were closest to where the explosion went off and massacred 26 unarmed civilians, everything from very, very young children on up to a 76-year-old man. Their initial report on the event and why this is being classified as a scandal by the mainstream media is that the Marines basically lied about it and they tried to cover it up. They wrote, their initial report was that they were hit by a roadside bomb and simultaneously attacked by armed gunmen. They fired back fiercely and killed the eight of the gunmen that attacked them. And then they claimed that 15 civilians were killed by the roadside bomb. The problem was there was video proof and photographic proof taken by Iraqi journalists in Haditha who showed up on the scene and documented it. And then Time magazine ended up covering the story a bit later and actually did a really good story on what happened, very accurately portrayed it, showed it as the massacre that it really was, and that's why now it's been brought into the mainstream attention.
Dar, do you recall the other massacre that happened in, I think, May 2004 in Ramadi and Al-Qa'im, the wedding event? Because I don't hear anything about it in the Western media. Now, all over the Arab networks, they are drawing parallel and juxtaposing a similar thing, because now it's kind of forgotten when the U.S. claimed that they have bombed infiltrators from Syria, Al-Qaeda infiltrators, and it turned up to be basically some, you know, big family wedding. They even showed pictures of the guy that was playing the organ when he was alive and then showed him dead. What do you think about that?
Well, I think that's an excellent example, and I hope that those kinds of parallels continue to be drawn, not just in Arab media, but back here in the United States, where it's even more important to try to wake people up about the fact that these kinds of atrocities are happening all the time. And that specific incident you mentioned, I remember writing about that too, because I was in Iraq at the time when that happened. That was in May of 2004, a wedding party that was basically annihilated by the U.S. military. They went in and killed at least 40 people. Again, there was photographic evidence, video proof, irrefutable evidence, statements made by doctors, other people living in the area, that this was simply an innocent wedding party that was literally decimated by the U.S. military. And we can really, you know, Jamal, we can go down the list of incidents like this. We can talk about Balad just in March of this year, where 11 people were massacred by the U.S. military. We can go to Latafia just a couple of months ago in February, when the U.S. military massacred 25 people. I mean, there's a long list. It's as if every other week, seemingly, there's a massacre on this level, and basically every day on smaller levels. Just like yesterday, two Iraqi women were killed, one of them pregnant, by the U.S. military. So you can essentially go down the history of the occupation and discuss, well, do we want to talk about one or two people being killed at checkpoints every single day by the U.S. military, or do we want to go on up to the level of Haditha, talking about 26 people, or do we want to go on up to the level of the second siege of Fallujah and talk about between 4,000 and 6,000 people being massacred by the U.S. military?
Why do you think now the admittance on the behalf of the U.S. administration, or at least they're paying attention to it, when before it was total denial? They had generals, because I remember watching the statements issued after the massacre in 2004 saying no, we stand by our statement. These are all terrorists that we killed. And, you know, and now they're actually, you know, trying to, I don't know, to say repent or whatever. Do you think this has anything to do with the Abu Ghraib?
I think it is. What it has to do with Abu Ghraib is it's basically the same type of damage control tactic that they're employing now as they did in Abu Ghraib. Because remember back to Abu Ghraib, we had irrefutable photographic evidence. We had soldiers that were being called out and were admitting to what they'd done. Irrefutable evidence. We had countless Iraqis on the ground who could testify about these things. And so to do damage control, they said, okay, we're going to admit to this, address it as a big problem, and then try to turn it around to benefit us by showing, yes, we can bring ourselves to justice and do these investigations and basically hand out a few soldiers that we're going to try and allow the media to basically attack and then put this behind us and make it look as though it was just a few bad apples. It's an isolated incident. We've got this repaired, and now we can keep moving forward. And I think that's what they're trying to do, and that's what a lot of the media is allowing them to do instead of continuing to focus on the fact, as Arab media is, as you said, let's start drawing the rest of these parallels between these countless number of other massacres that have occurred since the occupation began.
Well, that seems to be exactly the point, Dyer says. What the corporate and Western media appears to be focusing on is the fact that that a lie occurred, that there was a cover-up rather than the atrocities itself. And this seems deeply problematic. What do you think?
It's very, very problematic, and you know, frankly, it infuriates me, and it really, you know, the fact that these types of atrocities are occurring by the U.S. government against the people of Iraq. As an Arab American, it infuriates me, and even more as a human being, it infuriates me, and it insults my intelligence, and I hope it has the same effect on people who see this type of coverage, because it's similar, again, to what they did in Abu Ghraib. Instead of talking about the torture and the atrocities and the dehumanization that was going on and how rampant it was, the scandal was about, I even saw some mainstream sources reporting, well, the scandal was about these photos and they just simply shouldn't have been taken, and let's focus on the photos and make that the issue as opposed to these atrocities such as torture. And the same propaganda techniques being used, let's deflect away from the really core topic that we're talking about: war crimes. We're talking about murder that's punishable by death. We're talking about murdering innocent civilians.
That's the voice of Dyer Jamil, international independent media reporter, probably one of the foremost independent reporters on the situation in Iraq. We've been talking about the situation in Haditha. We're going to take a little break on Arab Talk right now, and we're going to have Dyer come back and talk about the larger picture of the elections in Iraq, the attempt to, pull together an Iraqi parliament, and the larger picture in the Middle East. So stay tuned on Arab Talk. This is KPOO 89.5 FM, San Francisco. All right, welcome back to Arab Talk. This is Arab Talk with Jess and Jamal. This is KPOO 89.5 FM in San Francisco. And on the line with us today, we have independent media journalist extraordinaire Dyer Jamil.
Dyer, I had earlier this morning an interview with a local channel here, and one of their questions was to me, well, okay, so what? I mean, you have collateral damage. This is a war after all. What would you say to this?
Well, I think, you know, first of all, they're calling it a war when in reality, it's an occupation. If they're going to admit to that, they have to. That's going to bring in the Geneva Conventions even stronger, that these individuals have committed gross violations of the Geneva Conventions. And again, I think that's a bit of deflection, but like this attempt to minimize. And I recently heard a Fox report, Fox so-called, well, quote-unquote news report, about taking that same tact of like, well, this is war and these things happen and this is the price of freedom, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that's basically a deflection from the fact of, well, you know, yes, an atrocity occurred. Everyone wishes that it hadn't. but we need to focus now. This brings to attention the fact that these individuals, each of these Marines that participated in the killing and those who perpetuated the lie and didn't report it right away, are all guilty of grave breaches of the Geneva Conventions. All are potentially subject to the penalty of death, and also that this has opened up the lid of a can of worms that needs to be addressed. Let's look at all of these massacres, because all of the Iraqi people are acutely aware of these things happening every single day, and I think that's evidenced by the fact that this incident, while it's been a wildfire in the media back here in the U.S., in Iraq, this is just just another day in the life of the occupation.
Exactly, and the complicity of the Western media here has to be called out, and thankfully we have some of the reporting by you that's doing that. Dar, let's just switch gears a little bit, because at simultaneously at the same time of the atrocities and the occupation in Iraq, they're attempting to form and complete the government. I wonder if you could give our listeners a kind of precis or summary of what's happening right now. They're getting close to naming the final two ministries, I think defense and security, but they're having a hard time. There seems to be a lot of infighting still.
Yes, there is, exactly. And these have been the issues that have been plaguing this Iraqi government since before it was even formed. I mean, these are issues that go back to the interim government, even under Iyad Alawi, where these contentious positions were already being discussed before the initial government was brought in January 3, 2005. And this is really going to continue. I really don't see this being resolved even once they do finally, whenever this will be. I don't suspect it will be sooner as opposed to later, but whenever they do finally agree on who's going to be in these positions, I certainly don't expect the debating to stop. And I certainly don't expect that the core issue here, I don't expect that we're going to have a government that's actually going to have any power respected by the people in order to start bringing about security, start bringing about some positive change in regards to the infrastructure, the electricity, and the water. I mean, we're in a situation now, it's so critical in Iraq. I think it's important also to note, this is somewhat off topic, but the fact that, you know, we're coming up on the midterm elections here. The Bush administration would love to be able to announce that they're going to be drawing down the number of troops in Iraq. And instead, we saw 2 days ago that they're having to send in 1,500 more troops from Kuwait into Al-Anbar province.
Exactly.
And that's on top of the fact that Italy now has announced that by the end of this month that we just started today, they'll have withdrawn almost half of their troops, and by the end of the year, they'll have withdrawn all 3,000 of their troops. That's from Nasiriyah. So more U.S. troops are going to have to go and take their place. And at the end of this year, there's only going to be three countries in Iraq that have over 1,000 troops. And those are the U.S., the U.K., and South Korea.
I guess that's the coalition of the willing.
Right, the coalition of the not willing anymore. It would be a more appropriate name, because the U.S. is basically left holding a bag now that is the occupation, that is on fire, and those flames are going wildly out of control. These are really key developments that are certainly going to increase violence and increase the likelihood of a greater number of U.S. troops being killed and wounded, and, of course, increase the likelihood of more atrocities like Haditha occurring.
Okay, Dar, let me just again draw a parallel here. Prime Minister Maliki announced, I think 2 days ago, that the iron fist of the Iraqi government would come down on Basra. Maybe you can comment on the phraseology that the current prime minister is using, kind of interesting. And then secondly, why is he talking about Basra now?
Well, Basra he's using this terminology, which is strikingly similar to like Operation Steel Curtain and Operation Iron Fist, which actually occurred out in the Al-Dora area of Baghdad back in December 03 and January 04. So it is, I'm sure, not so coincidental that he's using U.S. military type of jargon to do this. And it's really rather absurd, because we've already seen countless experiments run where this iron fist type of approach, like in Fallujah and in Mosul and in Talifar and Al Qaim, and how effective has those been in reducing violence and winning over more support for the occupation? They have consistently had the opposite effect on both of those. And with what's going on in Basra, we've got a situation where the British military has, at least several months ago, lost total control of the area. They've essentially taken the kinder, gentler occupation approach of turning more of the control over to the various militias, kind of the Afghanistan approach, if you will. And now they're suffering the fact that now they have lost so much control that these militias are now fighting each other for total control, and now launching more and more attacks on the Brits. More British soldiers were killed last month than since since the month of the invasion of Iraq. At least 60 attacks were launched against the Brits just last month alone.
And you can see how well the occupation is working in Afghanistan, because just 2 days ago we witnessed almost complete total breakdown in Kabul when an American military truck killed five innocent Afghans in the street.
Now, the situation on the ground, I mean, does not look promising. We have the Bush administration saying here that, you know, we're going to withdraw as soon as the Iraqi government tells us to do so, and as soon as they can take over and be in control. But what have you seen from the average Iraqi citizen on the street? Because you have this argument saying, well, if we withdraw, you're going to have a major war, you're going to have civil war and so forth. What do the Iraqis really want?
Well, the vast majority of Iraqis have been for a long time now in favor of an immediate withdrawal. And even if we cite a British military poll, the results were released October 24th of last year, and it focused even primarily in the South, where things were supposedly going better. Their own poll, which was conducted by Iraqi university students, found that 82% of Iraqis favored an immediate withdrawal, and less than 1% of those surveys found that the occupation forces even provided any more security for them. And kind of the joke amongst Iraqis when that poll came out was, yeah, that less than 1% are the expatriates who are hiding out in the green zone now, supposedly running this government. So it's very, very clear on the street that the vast majority of people really just can't tolerate this occupation any longer.
That's the voice of Dar Jamail, independent correspondent and reporter, probably one of the premier independent media reporters on the situation in Iraq. Dar, stay tuned, stay with us, okay? We're going to wrap it up after a quick musical break. This is Arab Talk on KPOO San Francisco, 89.5 FM. Arab Talk with Justin Jamal. This is KPOO San Francisco, 89.5 FM. And on the line with us from somewhere, I don't know where, but whatever, we have international independent media correspondent, Premier Dar Jamail.
Somewhere from his hiding place, so let's actually bring us to the subject. What have you been doing lately? I know you've been working on your book. Can you give us an update on your secret project?
Well, I'm not intentionally hiding out. I am up in Sonoma County back in California now, but I've been working pretty hard on my book. I don't really have a ETA for when that will
about,
be finished.
What's the book about, Dar?
I'm writing a book that's basically a first-person narrative of my experiences of spending 8 months in Iraq, but it's also going to be kind of a bit of an assault on the corporate media, because what I'm doing is, as I cover situations like the sieges of Fallujah, I write about exactly what I saw when I went in there, and then I contrast that with how it was reported back here in the U.S. So those are really the two themes of the book.
Which is actually a good topic to discuss briefly, because many people might have forgotten about what happened in Fallujah and what the government has stated what they're after and hunting and so forth, and what exactly did really happen. What did you see there, Dar?
Well, specifically, I think just talking briefly about the second siege, the November 2004 siege, and people here in the U.S. who will watch the corporate media about that see that, okay, there was this huge fight, a lot of Marines got killed, probably a lot of people in Fallujah got killed, but then they rooted out the terrorists and the town's okay and they've helped reconstruct it, this sort of thing. But the reality is that, as I said earlier, between 4,000 and 6,000 civilians were killed by the U.S. military during that siege. White phosphorus was used, which is a breach of the Geneva Conventions. It's an incendiary weapon. Depleted uranium was used, cluster bombs, all of these violations of the Geneva Conventions. 70% of the city was bombed to the point of being unlivable, and to this day, the U.S. military has never had total control of it from resistance fighters, and entire neighborhoods still remain without water and electricity, so they've essentially completely destroyed, or nearly completely destroyed, a city of 350,000 people. And what have they done but cause fighting to spread even further around Iraq?
So maybe we can just take a little analysis about the role of the corporate media in maintaining the occupation, Dar, because I think essentially what you're implying is that the corporate media, the Western media, has been complicit in facilitating the facade of bringing peace and democracy to Iraq right now.
That's exactly what I'm implying, because that is exactly the conclusions we reached. We had a World Tribunal on Iraq about this concerning media complicity in Rome, Italy, of February 2005. And I was invited to that to provide evidence. I did rely heavily on evidence I collected about Fallujah. And the end result of that tribunal was what we found is that corporate media was absolutely complicit in helping the invasion to occur, cheering it on, as a matter of fact, and then perpetuating it during the occupation. And they've actually violated two principles in international law. One of the Nuremberg principles, as well as the UNESCO Charter for Journalism, both state the primary concern for media during wartime is not to incite the public to violence. And that is exactly what the U.S. Corporate media have done, both before, during, and after the invasion of Iraq. They have absolutely incited the public to violence by not reporting accurately.
And people are still kind of surprised. They're kind of wondering why Iraqis, Palestinians, Afghans are so against occupation. Why do you think people continue to be surprised that there are peoples of the Arab world and Middle East who are against occupation, Dar?
I think that surprise is due directly to what we're talking about. It's because they don't have even the beginning of a clear picture of what occupation really looks like. What does war really look like? Instead, they're given this totally misrepresented photo provided by the mainstream media of, well, we do these surgical strikes, we only kill the bad guys, it's a clean war. We go in, we do the job, we help them reconstruct, and then we come out. This is what the public is led to believe by the media, and I think that's why they have such a horribly distorted picture of, for example, the occupation of Palestine or the occupation of Iraq or the occupation of Afghanistan.
When you went to the World Tribunal in Italy, and you must have, you know, came out with a statement or a conclusion, you know, I have to ask this: what kind of enforcement or teeth would you know, organizations like this be able to enforce on the culprits, the main culprits like the Fox News and so forth?
Well, that is really the toughest question that we have to continually deal with all of this, because the evidence is there. We have photographic video, written testimony evidence of war crimes, of media complicity. I mean, it's really irrefutable evidence, but the problem that we consistently run into is that since the U.S., and not just with the Bush administration, but under several administrations prior to this, will not join the International Criminal Court. So actually trying them for these war crimes, as long as the U.S. remains the sole superpower, is really the job faced with people. There are some organizations, for example, I know there's an attorney in San Francisco, Karen Parker, who has herself taken on, kind of put herself on a mission to try to figure out ways to navigate a way through this, to file some lawsuits, and I know she's active in that, but aside from just few rare exceptions like her, it's really an uphill battle, and I'm not a legal expert, but I feel like the best thing we can do now is keep documenting all this information so that hopefully at some point, like what happened during the Nuremberg trials, we can bring some of these war criminals to justice.
That's the voice of Dar Jamil, international independent reporter, speaking about his experiences in Iraq, as well as his experience on a tribunal that was held in Rome, Italy. Dar, okay, it's time to talk about connecting the dots, play connect the dots. I'm going to say four countries to you. You connect the dots. Palestine, Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan.
I would say U.S. involvement in the past as far as helping to facilitate the situations that each of those countries is facing today, as well as either direct or indirect military involvement historically as well as ongoing in the present day.
But to some extent, I mean, I'm just messing with you. You know that it's not just connected dots. It's a question to allow you and maybe Jamal and myself in a little while to articulate what's happening on the global arena in terms of these major occupations right now.
Well, I think at this point, again, if we look at all of those, if we have to talk about kind of two different scenarios, whether we're talking about from the Arab perspective, especially with Arab media outlets on each of these four situations, we look at U.S. involvement, U.S. support of the Israeli government, particularly the Israeli military, in all of these situations, and having it be a firestorm, that it's really not a good policy choice. It's really not conducive to peace in any of those countries, and certainly not back here in the U.S. either. But then if we look at it from a media perspective in the U.S., it's portrayed entirely different, where it's portrayed as, well, these are situations we have to go in there and try to help out because there's terrorism and this sort of thing, and a total misrepresentation in the news of what's actually happened in each of those four countries.
Do you think the U.S. Is bluffing as far as Iran, or do you think the Bush administration can afford another war or another invasion of a neighboring country such as Iran?
I think the problem we run into when we talk about the Bush administration in Iran is we tend to use logic, and that's the problem, because if we would have used logic, the U.S. would have never invaded and occupied Iraq, and they're basically doing the same thing to Iran, making up these reasons, manipulating the media to their advantage to basically try to justify a massive bombing campaign. And can they afford to do it with troops in the region that will then essentially come under about 10 times as much fire as they are right now, and other U.S. interests in that whole region coming under fire, and basically taking this slither of credibility that the U.S. might have left and just burying it underground deeply. The U.S. cannot afford to do it, but that certainly didn't stop these people with Iraq. And if we don't see a massive bombing campaign carried out by the U.S. prior to November, I'll be quite surprised.
That's the voice of Dar Jamal, independent media journalist, talking about a situation in Iraq. Dar, thank you so much for being on Arab Talk today. But before you go, would you please give our listeners your blog address and your website address, and just a pitch from Jamal, and I hurry up with your book. We want to read it real soon.
My pleasure. I'll get on it.
So where can people go to read your blogs and your writing?
And we want a signed copy, by the way.
Yeah, that's right.
Absolutely, you guys. Yeah, and my website where folks can read my news stories and see photographs and such, it's www.darjamailiraq.com. That's DarJamailIraq.com.
Thank you very much, Dar, and I'm sure we're going to have you back on Arab Talk really soon.
My pleasure. Thank you both.
Okay. Well, stay tuned. We're going to take a little musical break right now, and we're going to come back and wrap it up on Arab Talk. And if you happen not wanting to spend a lot of money and you want to call toll-free, you can call 866-405-0200. So, Jamal, I mean, let's just kind of open up the discussion line here a little bit and talk about what's happening. I mean, I think Dar painted a very bleak but realistic picture about the situation in Iraq, and Phil is painting a very realistic and bleak picture of the situation in Palestine. I know that one of the things that Phil didn't talk about is that today the Israeli military basically extrajudicially assassinated an entire family in Gaza, including a 4- and a 6-year-old child. And the situation in Gaza remains very, very bleak. In fact, the food, medicine shortages in Gaza right now are very extreme, and despite what we're seeing in the corporate media, and we're hearing that, in fact, the Israeli government as well as the United States wants to put forward humanitarian aid, there's no money and little to no food and no medicine getting into Gaza right now. So the situation continues to be bleak, and there's absolutely no coverage in the corporate media about this.
Well, I mean, the only coverage we had here, which is a glorious coverage, a victorious coverage, is the visit of Mr. Olmert.
Mr. Olmert came to Washington?
When Mr. Olmert came to Washington, he came to Washington to get the blessings of the Bush administration and other blessings to take another unilateral action, in fact, that, you know, Israel can take and decide how they're going to draw their border and ask for $10 billion more dollars. But I think we have here a caller on
the
line.
Yeah, and Jamal, I think we have a caller on the line. Jamal,
hello,
I think...
Hello.
Hi, do you have a question for Arab Talk?
Yes, I do.
What's your question?
What would you think of the idea of all the Arab states forming a united nation? In other words, that's the way the United States became such a powerful country, is simply 50 little states like Palestine all combined into one government, one language, one legal system. And it seems that the Arab states were to unite through one legal system, even through the United Nations, that they would have a more powerful military force.
Well, thank you for your question, caller. Jamal, what do you think about that?
Well, I share the enthusiasm of the caller, and this was a dream of actually Gamal Abdel Nasser, who started the Arab nationalism movement after King Farouk, and of course before him the British occupation. And of course he managed to unite Syria, a little bit Iraq, and then Yemen was joining, and then this all that project, you know, collapse. And I can only blame, you know, we cannot, you know, just keep putting the blame on the West, even though at that period, people got to understand that the Arab world was dissected by, you know, the colonial powers of France and England. But then they couldn't. They had internal conflicts and problems, started by the Saudis, who started this whole problem in Yemen. So it is a great idea. I mean, as a beginning, they should do something like get an EU, you know, thing going.
Hey, Jamal, I think we have another question. So let's take another call. Let's take another question. Caller, do you have a question for myself and Jamal?
Yes, I do. Thanks for a great show.
Sure.
I was wondering. I never hear anything as far as corporate media goes with regard to Israeli intelligence involvement in this whole occupation thing, specifically Mossad. Can you comment on that?
Well, you know, thank you for your question. I think there's a lot to say about that, and there's been a lot of reports, both historically and in the Arab media as well as the independent media, of a very active involvement of the Mossad and the Shin Bet, all of the Israeli intelligence services that are actively working in the Kurdish areas, so-called Kurdistan, in the north of Iraq. And they've been operating in that area trying to destabilize the region for, I don't know, Jamal, decades and decades and decades. In fact, that was their base that they operated from when they were infiltrating Iran during the Shah of Iran's time, as well as in the post-revolutionary time. But you're quite correct, caller. This is something that you never hear about. We know that, for example,
Well, let's just also remind our listeners that the Mossad also operates in the United States, and they've spied on the United States, you know, the whole, you know,
Jonathan Pollard,
and before that, and the corporate media buries those stories.
Well, what about the APEC story, when you had someone within the State Department actually passing on secrets to two top administrators of APEC, and that's a story that continues to be buried. So I think the caller's question is very important, and it illustrates the kind of complicity that Dar Jamal was talking about, that we were talking about ahead of time, the complicity that the media has in this country towards facilitating the progressive colonization and neo-colonial conquest of the Arab world.
Unfortunately, I mean, he was also honest about it. I mean, we could have all these meetings, and you cannot, at the end of the day, you know, enforce any rules or regulations.
No, we're talking about just getting the word out, right?
You get the word out. And my question is to the corporate media here. Now, once you have the veil of lies of the Bush administration justifying the war on Iraq, and their cheering or their role as cheerleaders. Now, they have supported a war, an unjust war, a war that was based on lies. And then they covered up to massacres and covered up to Abu Ghraib and stuff like this. What are they going to do after all these, this pyramid of lies come tumbling down? How they're going to justify that to their viewers, listeners?
Well, I think that they'll probably do the same thing that they did after Vietnam. I mean, they'll probably turn the tables on the government and come clean. But by that time, the carnage and the devastation to Iraq, to Palestine, to Afghanistan, and to the rest of the world will be tremendous. You've been listening to Arab Talk here, another very fast-moving show, Jamal. This is Arab Talk KPOO 89.5 FM in San Francisco. Next week, Jamal, next week, what's happening next week?
Next week, our guest will be Asad Abu Khalil, a.k.a.
The Angry Arab?
The Angry Arab.
So we're going to have three Angry Arabs next week, everybody. Stay tuned for Arab Talk, KPOO 89.5 FM, next Thursday, 2 p.m. See you then. Walking alone, that's why I'm dropping these poems off the top of my dome. Ancestors, flamethrowers, not some rolling stones. Never hold the chrome, still they hold their own. I'm trying to elevate my people to a whole other zone. So where we going, not down, our direction is top. Keep on doing what we doing and we ain't gonna stop. Through this consciousness and activism plus hip hop, we gon' stay working for the cause and grind around the clock. Used to serve on my flock, the promises of peace. Until we get our peace, there ain't gonna be peace. Until I rest beneath the earth, I will not quit it. I'm a fearless team, so you know I got to get it. B-dub, rag top, I am Sheik, stay committed, this one's a hot one. And them Arab boys did it. Rise up from the struggle through the rubble of bulldozers. Don't give up until this bullshit's over.